The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan Subscribe and Drive. No deposit, no compromise, no fuss. Find out more at nissan.ie.
Now, we're continuing News Talk's coverage of the passing of John Hume at the age of 83. He was, of course, a civil rights icon, instrumental in the peace process and Good Friday Agreement. John was suitably lauded during his lifetime with a Nobel Prize, a Martin Luther King Award, and indeed many other awards. We're going to hear some tributes from a number of people in the next few minutes, people that worked very closely with him. First up, I'm joined by Mark Durkin, former leader of the SDLP. Good evening, Mark. Very sad news on a professional, but especially on a personal level today for you.
Hugely sad news. Obviously, all of our hearts go out to Pat and John's family. But those of us who worked closely with John over many years just knew his qualities. We could see those qualities up close, and we knew that there wasn't that much difference between everything he said and did in public and how he behaved in private. He had absolute integrity in his convictions. He was constant, he was consistent, and that word he liked to be used about himself, stickability. He stuck at everything for very good reasons, because he really believed in being a change maker, and he also committed himself to being a peacemaker. And he was both, and he transformed so many lives.
It is interesting today, because obviously all the great and the good are coming out and offering their condolences and their perspective on his career and his achievements. But of course, he's been sadly absent from the spotlight for the last decade or two. And it was interesting, just in my own home, I have an 18, a 22 and a 28 year old, and they know very little about John Hume. They know quite a lot about the other major players in the peace process, and they know that a man called John Hume, had something to do with it. But there is now almost a generation or two generations who don't realise just how much he had to do with it, and that without him, it certainly would not have happened at that time.
Yes, I mean, he was the pathfinder. It was his analysis, it was his driven ideas that ensured we had a peace process, and ensured that it was a peace process that could involve inclusive political dialogue, that would end up with inclusive political institutions, And so John was someone, his contribution has been taken for granted, and we see so many other landmark events and celebrations of the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. And because John's not able to appear and take part in those things, he has somewhat been eclipsed in public memory and in the awareness of a younger generation. But today, I suppose, is an opportunity for us all to remember just the strength of the legacy that so many now take for granted. The fact is, whenever John Hume came up with the analysis that the Northern Ireland problem involved three sets of relationships, first of all within Northern Ireland, secondly within Ireland, North and South, and thirdly within or between Ireland and Britain. That analysis was rejected by unionism, it was rejected by physical force republicanism, but everybody came to accept that analysis whenever they agreed to negotiations that were based on the so-called three strands, which was about relations in Northern Ireland with strand one, relations within the island of Ireland, strand two, relations between Ireland and Britain was strand three. So, the stone that the wreck rejected for so many years actually became the cornerstone of the very agreement that the people of Ireland were able to vote on in 1998. And remember, that John's idea as well. It was he who had the idea that if we can get talks involving all the parties, we agree at the start that any agreement has to be voted on by the people of Ireland, North and South. That means if a majority supported in the North, it's legitimate for unionism. If a majority supported North and South, therefore it has a majority in the island as a whole, that makes it legitimate for nationalism. And that meant that both unionists and nationalists could accord equal legitimacy to institutions for the first time, and those would be shared institutions. When John talked about that first, that was dismissed by unionism, it was dismissed by Sinn Féin, but the fact is that was what they came to accept, and it's what the Irish people overwhelmingly endorsed and legitimised when they voted so resoundingly for the Good Friday Agreement. And it's that democratic integrity of the agreement that has meant it has survived so many strains and stresses since.
I heard Gerry Adams say today that sometimes the hardest, toughest battles you have to fight are with your own. And he would have met a lot of resistance from within the SDLP at the time. I mean, you know, he's being eulogised today, but I'm old enough to remember that he was excoriated for what he was doing in the first place by the establishment, political, both North and South, and also the media establishment. There were a lot of people said, John, what in the name of God are you doing talking to these people? You know, this is a bad idea. You should have nothing to do with them. You're completely anti-violence. Forgetting, of course, that the only way you can get to get a fellow to put his gun down is actually go and talk to him and give him very good reason why he should.
Yes, and at that time, John knew that there was going to be huge reputational risk, and John had felt it when they saw some of the personalism, and it went towards outright vilification. But John was very clear at the time, and would say to those of us who were working with him, look, I don't believe that anybody's opinion about the ARA and their violence is going to change because I'm talking to Gerry Adams. But I have to accept that clearly some people's opinion of me is going to have to change. But if I believe that dialogue is the answer and that people who are using violence need to be persuaded of the value of dialogue, how am I going to persuade them if I say I won't do dialogue with them? And it was just that searing logic that he had to be listening. Also the case, he had said at the time of the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985 that unison was going to have to adjust and they were going to have to come to that realisation. But he also said that the fact and form of the Anglo-Irish Agreement, that constitutional nationalism needed to offer a new challenge, a political way forward that rendered their previous justification for violence no longer current. And so he believed he had to show strongly, he believes that, by being prepared to make that argument in close quarters with Sinn Féin leaders, and that's what he did. Yes, many people doubted it at the time, but that was because IRA violence was continuing at the time, and there were grave atrocities continuing, and that really did cause stress to both John and to Pat at the time. But they knew that the violence wasn't continuing because of his dialogue. He certainly knew the violence was going to continue without dialogue.
What was it he said? We will shed. What was it, the thing he said about it? We should shed our sweat and not our blood. Mark,
yes,
listen.
He always had pillars in our blood. That was one of what John himself called the single transferable speech. You see, many people use the phrase single transferable speech today, but it was John who used that phrase himself all the time. And of course, and that was because he had a constant message. He had a consistency. He would always tell you, look, if the underlying problem hasn't changed, the underlying solution hasn't changed. He didn't react in a fickle way to events. He didn't play mood politics. You know, so the sort of capriciousness that you now see from politicians in the social media age of people adopting different positions and all the rest of it, that wasn't John Hume. He had a true and steady compass. So he was very, very clear that he didn't react to reaction.
Yeah, Mark, listen, I just want to say on behalf of everybody down here to express our condolences at you and the nationalist population's loss up there, because hindsight being 2020, we have just, today is the passing of a titan of Irish politics, a titan of international politics, and we don't see them often, and we're not likely to see the like of him again in a hurry. So that's Mark Durkin there, a former leader of the SDLP. It's News Talk, The Hard Shoulder, and we are talking about the passing of John Hume. I'm joined on the line now by Jonathan Powell, who was Tony Blair's chief of staff from 1995 to 2007 and was chief government negotiator on Northern Ireland. Good afternoon, Mr. Powell. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Can you remember the first time you met John Hume and what you made of him?
Yes, I first met John Hume in 91. I've been sent out to the British Embassy in Washington. This was before I worked for Tony Blair. And my job was to take the argument of Northern Ireland up on the Hill in Congress. So I went to meet John Hume. And it made the impression on me then that stuck with me once I joined Tony Blair in government. And that was of a very straightforward politician. Many politicians, you get many different faces. But with John Hume, what you saw was what you got. He was very straightforward. He was very determined to get to peace. He had an overriding determination to get there. And in the end, he succeeded and will always be remembered in history because he did that.
He at that stage, he had a pretty well-established political career and he would have been a force. So you would have been aware of his, I suppose, of his weight and his power. Did what was it like in the room when you first walked into him? Was he a welcoming presence? Was he an intimidating presence? Did you think, I better have my stuff together now when I'm dealing with this guy?
He wasn't intimidating at all, no. He was a very nice man, a very kind man, very considerate man. He had, as you said, already got a considerable political reputation because he'd been so brave. He'd been brave in standing up for civil rights. He'd been brave in standing up against violence in the IRA, even though he lived in the Brookside. He'd been brave in convincing the American public, along with the so-called four horsemen of the apocalypse in the US Congress, including Senator Kennedy, to stop giving money to the IRA and to NORAD. And then he'd been brave in reaching out to Gerry Adams and the IRA to try and get to peace and being excoriated by the British media and British elite for doing so.
And the Irish media elite as well, too, it has to be said. He got it in the neck from all...
He was right and the rest of us were wrong.
Yeah, you've had a very long career both in politics and observing it, and you know the old adage about, you know, politicians are looking at the next election, statesmen are looking at the next generation. I think by any measure, John Hume is one of the most important statesmen to have worked on these islands in the last 50 years, possibly 100.
Yes, the remarkable thing was he actually sacrificed his own political party, the SDLP, and his own political fortune in order to get to peace. Now, he could have been Deputy First Minister instead of Seamus. He, the whole way through, he had this fixation on trying to get to a just peace, a peace where people could be equal and could live alongside each other. He was determined it could be done. No one else believed it could. And by his persistence, he drove us all through. Not everyone who gets the Nobel Peace Prize deserves it, but he certainly did.
Well, of course, he gave the money away, and to be honest with you, he wasn't a wealthy man, so I'm sure he and the family could have put it to very good use. But again, another mark of the man. I was mentioning this with Mark Durkin, that I have children who are 18, 22, 28, and while they would know a lot about the peace process and the main players in it, John Hume has faded to the background, which is quite sad, obviously because of his illness. He hasn't been in the spotlight or been doing the speaking engagements and circuit that a lot of the others have. And there is almost, I got a sense today while listening to the eulogies, that there is also another he is getting his due now, but he hasn't got it for the last 10 years. Is that a fair assessment?
I'm not sure he ever got enough appreciation for what he did, even when he was active in politics or the years after he'd really given up active politics. So I don't think it's just that he's been sick and out of action for a long time. I think it's also that people tended to begrudge him what he deserved. He had a prickly relationship with some of the unionist politicians that made things difficult. And he had been a real sort of a hammer on the IRA. So on both sides, there were people who didn't necessarily like him. But I think the history will be extremely kind to him. I think he did play the key role in bringing about peace in Northern Ireland. He did have the ideas and the inspiration. So regardless of whether he's been in the news over the last 10 years, I think when people come to write the history books, he will get his due place.
Well, look, there are politicians and political operators, and then there are world class. And I think by any measure that John Hume would be in the world class category.
Absolutely. It was amazing to me as a former diplomat in the United States, he was virtually a saint. He was acknowledged by everyone, absolutely everyone, on all sides. Well, and then also in Europe, where he's a really big figure. So I think that's right. He was a very big politician.
Well, if you look at the history of Europe, the recent history of Europe, Jacques Delors and Helmut Kohl are two of the most, the heaviest hitters that we've had in the last 50 years. And both of them instantly liked him, instantly recognised that he was a serious operator and that he was in the same class as them in terms of his vision about the future and how things should work, go forward. So I suppose that in itself is as much of an endorsement as you would want. Just finally,
both of them actually achieved something. Most politicians achieve very little by the time they leave politics. Kohl achieved the United Ireland, Delors changed the European Union beyond recognition, and John Hume changed Ireland. And I think all three of them therefore have that big reputation, as you said, as statesmen rather than just as politicians.
Mm. Oh, Jonathan Powell, we'll leave it there. So, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. That is Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's Chief of Staff from the 95 to 2007 period. You're listening to News Talk. It's The Hard Shoulder. It's Mark Cagney, and I'm now joined by former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. Good afternoon, Mr. Ahern. Obviously a very sad day, although I think a lot of people would have, particularly people who knew him well, would have known that John Hume was not in good health and that this was probably coming. But a bad and a sad day nonetheless.
Yeah, it's a sad day. I mean, poor John has had a long run of dementia. So, you know, he hasn't been with us or with his family for a long way back. But it's still the ending of an era. And, you know, I spent a fair bit of the early part of the year with Seamus Mallon, and you know, Seamus was in great memory form. He was, you know, the mind was as bright as a whistle, and he recalled all that. I was with him just a few days before he died, and but John had lost that, and you know, but I think we look back on the contribution that he made, and he was such a significant figure. You know, not it's not just the peace process, but John was right through all of that period from 1968 on, through the civil rights movement, to the housing association, to the founding of the SDLP, to all the years of the Troubles. And then he was elected to the old Stormont before it was abolished in 72. And then he was in Westminster in Europe. And, you know, he did so much to bring the Irish-American thing together, and right, to try and counteract the British influence on the Irish problem by building up the American connection. So he's had literally 40 plus years of being a hugely significant person. So in historical terms, I the likes of that will not be seen again. People just don't get that, you know, long role of key leadership that John had.
Yeah, Tommy Gorman has a lovely piece about him today, and the headline on it is a politician with all of the gifts. And I keep thinking of kind of football analogies here. If he was a footballer, he'd be in the Messi-Ronaldo category. He'd be world class. And you don't get many of them to the pound, do you?
No, that's exactly, Mark. I mean, he was so well known. Like, he was a big figure in America. You know, they all knew him in Capitol Hill, and he knew, you know, several presidents. I mean, Tip O'Neill was his big friend, and Ted Kennedy. I was lucky enough in the early 80s to be over and to be part of a week's delegation with him. And I'd kind of known of him in my whip days in the Dáil, when he used to come down, always call down, he'd be called into Charlie Hott, he'd be giving you advice about this, that and the other. But he brought down the SDLP delegations. But in America, he was just like, you know, I think Irish people maybe don't fully realise it, because you don't see what's going on over there. But from the early 80s, he built that up. And then he was so well-liked in Europe. You know, he was a fluent French speaker, so he was able to, French was his university subject, and I think that was a huge help to him in the European part. With the law, when the law was present in the Europe, he and the law got on really well. And John was always trying to get money for Derry. I mean, he was certainly, well, he was an international politician. And when it came to the town I love so well, which he'd sing for you at the drop of a hat, but fighting for money and resources and infrastructure for Derry was his big thing. And, you know, he did that so well for that, you know, Donegal, Derry. Love that part.
Mr. Hearn, there's a lot of eulogies and, you know, a lot of testimony about what he has done. What possibly isn't being discussed today is just how much a political risk it was for him to do what he did when he did it. Now, I'm around long enough to remember awful editorials in Irish press, not alone the UK press, but down here, some excoriating columns and op-eds about talking to Gerry Adams and talking to the IRA. When he first mooted that to those of you in the political sphere, what was your reaction? Was it, are you mad? Do you want to ruin your career? Or hang on a second, there might be a glimpse of daylight here.
Yeah, well, to be honest, Mark, I was supportive of it, but I could see the risks of it. And I was genuinely surprised at the backlash of media interest, not so much in across the ponds, but here. I mean, he was truly savaged for it, as you correctly said, you remember it. And like, it went on Sunday after Sunday, and he really got a rough time over it. And like, what he if I could put in a few sentences, his take was that if the only way of bringing an end to this was to bring people in out of the cold. And he believed, while there was a political risk for constitutionalist parties to bring in people who were engaged in violence, that if you didn't try to convince them of the constitutional peaceful line, you were never going to bring an end to the trouble. I mean, that was the philosophy. And of course, you know, people said, and we all recall it, that they said, no, this is impossible, these people will never come in. And you know, but he kept at it and kept at it. But he was, I was with him and very close to him during those times. He was very hurt by it. I mean, it didn't roll off, duck off water. It's no good people saying now that he didn't notice or didn't feel it. He did, and he was disappointed with it. But, you know, he prevailed, and that was the important thing. He kept at it, and he encouraged guys like me to keep at it. And you know, he was a huge influencer on you know, what we were trying to do. And he was saying, if you don't take risks, you won't solve this problem.
What about his relationship with David Trimble? Because they didn't seem to me like the kind of fellas who'd be going off for a pint in the normal course of event.
No, that's definite. But funny enough, you know, one of the things, and I don't know if anyone has made the point today, but he used to get great satisfaction out of in Europe. And the Paisley and Jim Nicholson, who was the UUP representative at the time, they'd be giving him a tough time in Northern Ireland politics. But when they were in Europe and they were fighting for fisheries and agriculture, the three of them used to go down to delegations together. And John got great satisfaction that, you know, all these people in Europe would hear about all the troubles in Northern Ireland. And then in marches, Ian Paisley, John Hume, and Jim Nicholson of the UUP, and they'd all fight together for the cause, and then they go out to the door and the fight to continue on about Northern Ireland. But it was it just showed that he was prepared to play and get the others to play horses for courses, and he did that really, really well. David Trimble and himself, you know, David, I got on very well with David, but David could fly off the handle very quickly, and John wasn't that kind of a guy. So I think there had to be a little bit of work for him to handle David. But they ended up very, very close, and because they ended up Nobel Peace Prize together.
Indeed. Did you have much contact with him afterwards?
I did. You know, right up until recent years, and then. You know, one of the things that was sad, Mark, you know, in recent, we're not now in the last 5 years now, but you know, it was no contact. But before that, he would ring to give you advice, and when I knew things were getting bad for him, he would ring maybe at 9 o'clock in the morning, and he would give you advice, and then you got the same call at 11 and 1 and 3, and you know, he gave you the same advice, but I'm afraid, you know, life has got difficulty for him, but he was so kind. And I did have one of my last meetings with him was in my own local. We used to come down from Derry in the bus, and the bus driver used to drop him at my office. Literally, there's no bus stop at the office, but he used to drop him at the office, and then my drivers used to bring him back to the Derry bus in town. But we had arranged a meeting with Angus Fanning and John Hume and myself. And you can imagine what we were discussing. And it was to try and make peace after some of those articles you mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, it's you know, it is a sad day, and I mentioned this a little earlier on, and this is no disrespect to you and to a lot of your colleagues and peers, but you know, good politicians have their eye on the next election, statesmen have their eye on the next generation, and in fairness, we haven't had too many great statesmen, but I think he definitely is one of the towering figures of Irish political life, this side of the border and the other side, and indeed across the water in the last 50 years, if not longer.
No, there's no doubt about that. I mean, he 50 years at the top of the game, and 50 years of making a huge, huge difference to the current and future generations on the island of Ireland, and that will be his legacy.
Bertie Ahern, former Taoiseach, thank you so much for joining us.